This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison by Piper Kerman. Read for you by Cassandra Campbell.
Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. From Anthem by Leonard Cohen. Author's note. This book is a memoir and is drawn from my own experience. All of the names, and in some cases distinguishing characteristics, of the people who lived and worked inside of the prisons where I was held have been changed to afford them their privacy. The exceptions are Sister Ardith Platty and Alice Gerard, who kindly granted me permission to use their real names. Chapter 1. Are you going to go my way? International baggage claim in the Brussels airport was large and airy, with multiple carousels circling endlessly. I scurried from one to another, desperately trying to find my black suitcase. Because it was stuffed with drug money, I was more concerned than one might normally be about lost luggage. I was 24 in 1993, and probably looked like just another anxious young professional woman. My Doc Martens had been jettisoned in favor of beautiful handmade black suede heels. I wore black silk pants and a beige jacket, a typical jeune fille, not a bit counterculture, unless you spotted the tattoo on my neck. I had done exactly as I had been instructed, checking my bag in Chicago through Paris, where I had to switch planes to take a short flight to Brussels. When I arrived in Belgium, I looked for my black Rolly at the baggage claim. It was nowhere to be seen. Fighting a rushing tide of panic, I asked in my mangled high school French what had become of my suitcase. "Bags don't make it onto the right flight sometimes," said the big lug working in baggage handling. "Wait for the next shuttle from Paris. It's probably on that plane." Had my bag been detected? I knew that carrying more than $10,000 undeclared was illegal, let alone carrying it for a West African drug lord. Were the authorities closing in on me? Maybe I should try to get through customs and run? Or perhaps the bag really was just delayed, and I would be abandoning a large sum of money that belonged to someone who could probably have me killed with a simple phone call. I decided that the latter choice was slightly more terrifying. So I waited. The next flight from Paris finally arrived. I sidled over to my new friend in baggage handling, who was sorting things out. It's hard to flirt when you're frightened. I spotted the suitcase. "Mon bag!" I exclaimed in ecstasy, seizing the to me. I thanked him effusively, waving with giddy affection as I sailed through one of the unmanned doors into the terminal, where I spotted my friend Billy waiting for me. I had inadvertently skipped customs. "I was worried. What happened?" Billy asked. "Get me into a cab," I hissed. I didn't breathe until we had pulled away from the airport and were halfway across Brussels. My graduation processional at Smith College the year before was on a perfect New England spring day. In the sun-dappled quad, bagpipes whined and Texas Governor Ann Richards exhorted my classmates and me to get out there and show the world what kind of women we were. My family was proud and beaming as I took my degree. My freshly separated parents were on their best behavior. My stately southern grandparents pleased to see their oldest grandchild wearing a mortarboard and surrounded by wasps and ivy. My little brother bored out of his mind. My more organized and goal-oriented classmates set off for their graduate school programs or entry-level jobs at nonprofits, or they moved back home, not uncommon during the depths of the first Bush recession. I, on the other hand, stayed on in Northampton, Massachusetts. I had majored in theater, much to the skepticism of my father and grandfather. I came from a family that prized education. We were a clan of doctors and lawyers and teachers, with the odd nurse, poet, or judge thrown into the mix. After 4 years of study, I still felt like a dilettante, underqualified and unmotivated for a life in the theater, but neither did I have an alternate plan for academic studies, a meaningful career, or the great default, law school. I wasn't lazy. I had always worked hard through my college jobs in restaurants, bars, and nightclubs, winning the affection of my bosses and co-workers via sweat, humor, and a willingness to work doubles. Those jobs and those people were more my speed than many of the people I had met at college. I was glad that I had chosen Smith, a college full of smart and dynamic women. But I was finished with what was required of me by birth and background. I had chafed within the safe confines of Smith, graduating by a narrow margin, and I longed to experience, experiment, investigate. It was time for me to live my own life. I was a well-educated young lady from Boston with a thirst for bohemian counterculture and no clear plan. But I had no idea what to do with all my pent-up longing for adventure, or how to make my eagerness to take risks productive. No scientific or analytical bent was evident in my thinking. What I valued was artistry and effort and emotion. I got an apartment with a fellow theater grad and her nutty artist girlfriend, and a job waiting tables at a microbrewery. I bonded with fellow waitrons, bartenders, and musicians, all equally nubile and constantly clad in black. We worked, we threw parties, we went skinny dipping or sledding, we fucked, sometimes we fell in love. We got tattoos. I enjoyed everything Northampton and the surrounding Pioneer Valley had to offer. I ran for miles and miles on country lanes, learned how to carry a dozen pints of beer up steep stairs, indulged in numerous romantic peccadillos with appetizing girls and boys, and journeyed to Provincetown for midweek beach excursions on my days off throughout the summer and fall. When winter set in, I began to grow uneasy. My friends from school told me about their jobs and their lives in New York, Washington, and San Francisco, and I wondered what the hell I was doing. I knew I wasn't going back to Boston. I loved my family, but the fallout of my parents' divorce was something I wanted to avoid completely. In retrospect, a Eurorail ticket or volunteering in Bangladesh would have been brilliant choices, but I stayed stuck in the valley. Among our loose social circle was a clique of impossibly stylish and cool lesbians in their mid-30s. These worldly and sophisticated older women made me feel uncharacteristically shy, but when several of them moved in next door to my apartment, we became friends. Among them was a raspy-voiced Midwesterner named Nora Jansen, who had a mop of curly sandy brown hair. Nora was short and looked a bit like a French bulldog, or maybe a white Eartha Kitt. Everything about her was droll, her drawling, wise-cracking, husky voice, the way she cocked her head to look at you with bright brown eyes from under her mop, even the way she held her ever-present cigarette, wrist flexed and ready for gesture. She had a playful, watchful way of drawing a person out, and when she paid you attention, it felt as if she were about to let you in on a private joke. Nora was the only one of that group of older women who paid any attention to me. It wasn't exactly love at first sight, but in Northampton, to a 22-year-old looking for adventure, she was a figure of intrigue. And then, in the fall of 1992, she was gone. She reappeared after Christmas. Now she rented a big apartment of her own, furnished with brand-new arts and crafts-style furniture and a killer stereo. Everyone else I knew was sitting on thrift store couches with their roommates while she was throwing money around in a way that got attention. Nora asked me out for a drink, just the two of us, which was a first. Was it a date? Perhaps it was, because she took me to the bar of the Hotel Northampton, the closest local approximation to a swank hotel lounge, painted pale green with white trellis work everywhere. I nervously ordered a margarita with salt, at which Nora arched a brow. "Sort of chilly for a marg," she commented as she asked for a scotch. It was true. The January winds were making Western Massachusetts uninviting. I should have ordered something dark in a smaller glass. My frosty margarita now seemed ridiculously juvenile. "What's that?" she asked, indicating the little metal box I had placed on the table. The box was yellow and green and had originally held sour lemon pastilles. Napoleon gazed westward from its lid, identifiable by his cocked hat and gold epaulettes. The box had served as a wallet for a woman I'd known at Smith, an upper-class woman who was the coolest person I had ever met. She had gone to art school, lived off campus, was wry and curious and kind and super hip. And one day when I had admired the box, she gave it to me. It was the perfect size for a pack of cigarettes, a license, and a 20. When I tried to pull money out of my treasured tin wallet to pay for the round, Nora waved it away. "Where had she been for so many months?" I asked, and Nora gave me an appraising once-over. She calmly explained to me that she had been brought into a drug smuggling enterprise by a friend of her sister, who was connected, and that she had gone to Europe and been formally trained in the ways of the underworld by an American art dealer who was also connected. She had smuggled drugs into this country and been paid handsomely for her work. I was completely floored. Why was Nora telling me this? What if I went to the police? I ordered another drink, half certain that Nora was making the entire thing up and that this was the most harebrained seduction attempt ever. I had met Nora's younger sister once before, when she came to visit. She went by the name of Hester and was into the occult and would leave a trail of charms and feathered trinkets made of chicken bones. I thought she was just a Wiccan heterosexual version of her sister, but apparently she was the lover of a West African drug kingpin. Nora described how she had traveled with Hester to Benin to meet the kingpin, who went by the name of Alaji and bore a striking resemblance to MC Hammer. She had stayed as a guest at his compound, witnessed and been subject to witch doctor ministrations, and was now considered his sister-in-law. It all sounded dark, awful, scary, wild, and exciting beyond belief. I couldn't believe that she, the keeper of so many terrifying and tantalizing secrets, was taking me into her confidence. It was as if by revealing her secrets to me, Nora had bound me to her, and a secretive courtship began. No one would call Nora a classic beauty, but she had wit and charm in excess and was a master at the art of seeming effortlessness. And, as has always been true, I respond to people who come after me with clear determination. In her seduction of me, she was both persistent and patient. Over the months that followed, we grew much closer, and I learned that a number of local guys I knew were secretly working for her, which proved reassuring to me. I was entranced by the illicit adventure Nora represented. When she was in Europe or Southeast Asia for a long period of time, I all but moved into her house, caring for her beloved black cats, Edith and Dum Dum. She would call at odd hours of the night from the other side of the globe to see how the kitties were, and the phone line would click and hiss with the distance. I kept all this quiet, even as I was dodging questions from my already curious friends. Since business was conducted out of town, the reality of the drugs felt like a complete abstraction to me. I didn't know anyone who used heroin, and the suffering of addiction was not something I thought about. One day in the spring, Nora returned home with a brand new white Miata convertible and a suitcase full of money. She dumped the cash on the bed and rolled around in it, naked and giggling. It was her biggest payout yet. Soon, I was zipping around in that Miata, with Lenny Kravitz on the tape deck demanding to know, "Are you gonna go my way?" Despite, or perhaps because of, the bizarre romantic situation with Nora, I knew I needed to get out of Northampton and do something. My friend Lisa B. and I had been saving our tips and decided we would quit our jobs at the brewery and take off for San Francisco at the end of the summer. Lisa knew nothing about Nora's secret activities. When I told Nora, she replied that she would love to have an apartment in San Francisco and suggested that we fly out there and house hunt. I was shocked that she felt so strongly about me. Just weeks before I was to leave Northampton, Nora learned that she had to return to Indonesia. "Why don't you come with me? Keep me company," she suggested. "You don't have to do anything. Just hang out." I had never been out of the United States. Although I was supposed to begin my new life in California, the prospect was irresistible. I wanted an adventure, and Nora had one on offer. Nothing bad had ever happened to the guys from Northampton who had gone with her to exotic places as errand boys. In fact, they returned with high-flying stories that only a select group could even hear. I rationalized that there was no harm in keeping Nora company. She gave me money to purchase a ticket from San Francisco to Paris and said there would be a ticket to Bali waiting for me at the Garuda Air counter at Charles de Gaulle. It was that simple. Nora's cover for her illegal activities was that she and her partner in crime, a goateed guy named Jack, were starting an art and literary magazine. Questionable, but it lent itself to vagueness. When I explained to my friends and family that I was moving to San Francisco and would be working and traveling for the magazine, they were uniformly surprised and suspicious of my new job. But I rebuffed their questions, adopting the air of a woman of mystery. As I drove out of Northampton, headed west with my buddy Lisa, I felt as if I were finally embarking on my life. I felt ready for anything. Lisa and I drove nonstop from Massachusetts to the Montana border, taking turns sleeping and driving. In the middle of the night, we pulled into a rest stop to sleep, where we awoke to see the incredible golden eastern Montana dawn. I could not remember ever being so happy. After lingering in Big Sky country, we sped through Wyoming and Nevada until finally we sailed over the Bay Bridge into San Francisco. I had a plane to catch. What would I need for my journey to Indonesia? I had no idea. I packed one small L.L. Bean duffel bag with a pair of black silk pants, a tank dress, blue jean cutoffs, three t-shirts, a red silk shirt, a black mini skirt, my running gear, and a pair of black cowboy boots. I was so excited I forgot to pack a bathing suit. Upon arrival in Paris, I went straight to the Garuda counter to claim my ticket to Bali. They had never heard of me. Freaked out, I sat down at an airport restaurant, ordered a coffee, and tried to decide what to do. The days of cell phones and email were still in the future, and I had no idea how to reach Nora. I assumed something must have gotten lost in translation. Finally, I got up and went to the newsstand, bought a Paris guidebook, and picked out a cheap hotel that was centrally located in the 6th arrondissement. My one credit card had a very low limit. From my little room, I could see the rooftops of Paris. I called Jack, Nora's old friend and now business partner in the States. Snide and superior and obsessed with prostitutes, Jack was not one of my favorite people. "I'm stranded in Paris. Nothing Nora told me is right. What should I do?" I asked him. Jack was annoyed, but decided he could not leave me to my own devices. "Go find a Western Union. Tomorrow I'll wire you money for a ticket." The wire didn't come for several days, but I didn't mind. I wandered Paris in a haze of excitement, taking everything in. Alongside most French women, I looked like a teenager, so to counter this, I bought a pair of spidery and beautiful black crochet stockings to go with my Doc Martens and miniskirt. I didn't care if I ever left Paris. I was in heaven, all alone. When I got off the smoky 13-hour flight from Paris to Bali, I was surprised to find my former brewery coworker Billy waiting for me, towering above the Indonesians with a big grin on his freckled face. Billy could have passed for my brother, strawberry blonde with bright blue eyes. "Nora's waiting at the resort. You're going to love it here," he said. Reunited with Nora in our luxurious room, I felt shy with her in this unfamiliar setting. But she acted as if this were all perfectly normal. Bali was a bacchanalia, Days and nights of sunbathing, drinking, and dancing until all hours with Nora's crew of gay boys, any pretty locals who wanted to help us spend money, and young Euros and Aussies we met in the clubs at Kuta Beach. I went to the street market to buy a bikini and sarong, bartered for carved masks and silver jewelry, and walked the back roads of Nusa Dua, talking to the friendly locals. Expeditions to temples, parasailing and scuba diving offered other diversions. And the Balinese scuba instructors loved the long-finned, jeweled, and elegant bluefish that had been tattooed on my neck back in New England, and eagerly showed me their own tattoos. But the festivities were punctuated by tense phone calls between Nora and Alaji, or Nora and Jack. The way their business worked was simple. From West Africa, Alaji would make it known to select people in the States that he had contracts for units of drugs, usually custom-built suitcases with heroin sewn into the linings available. They could turn up at any number of places in the world. People like Nora and Jack, essentially subcontractors, would arrange to transport the suitcases into the States, where they were handed off to an anonymous pickup. It was up to them to figure out how to manage the transport, recruiting couriers, training them on how to get through customs undetected, paying for their vacations and their fees. Nora and Jack were not the only people with whom Alaji worked. In fact, Nora was now competing with Jonathan Bibby, the art dealer who had originally trained her for Alaji's business. The tension I observed in Nora derived from how many contracts were available, whether she and Jack could fulfill them, and whether the units of drugs would actually arrive as scheduled, all factors that seemed to change at a moment's notice. The job required lots of flexibility and lots of cash. When cash ran low, I would be sent off to retrieve money wires from Alaji at various banks, a crime itself, although I did not realize it. Then I was sent on one such errand in Jakarta. One of the intended drug couriers asked to come along for the ride. He was a young gay guy from Chicago who was heavily into goth but cleaned up well and looked the part of the perfect prepster. He was bored by the plush hotel. During the long, hot ride across the sprawling city, we were transfixed by the gridlock, the cages of barking puppies for sale at roadside, and the human strata that the Southeast Asian metropolis offers. At a traffic light, a beggar lay in the street asking for alms. His skin was almost blackened by the sun, and he had no legs. I started to roll down my window to give him some of the hundreds of thousands of rupiah that I had with me. My companion gasped and shrank back in his seat. "Don't!" he shouted. I looked at him, disgusted and perplexed. Our taxi driver took the money from me and handed it out his window to the beggar. We rode on in silence. We had tons of time to kill. We blew off steam in Bali beach clubs, Jakarta military pool halls, and nightclubs like Tanamer that were borderline brothels. Nora and I shopped, got facials, or journeyed to other parts of Indonesia. Just the two of us. Girl time. We didn't always get along. During a trip to Krakatoa, we hired a guide to lead us on a hike in the mountains, which were covered by dense, humid jungle growth. It was hot, sweaty going. We stopped to eat lunch by a beautiful river pool at the top of a towering waterfall. After a skinny dip, Nora dared me, double dog dared me to be precise, to jump off the falls, which were at least 35 feet high. "Have you seen people jump?" I asked our guide. "Oh, yes, miss," he said, smiling. "Have you ever jumped?" "Oh, no, miss," he said, still smiling. Still, a dare was a dare. Naked, I began to crawl down the rock that seemed like the most logical jumping place. The falls roared. I saw the churning, opaque green water far below. I was terrified, and this suddenly seemed like a bad idea. But the rock was slippery, and as I tried in vain to edge back like a crab, I realized that I was going to have to jump. There was no other way. I gathered all of my physical strength and flung myself off the rock and into the air, shrieking as I plunged deep into the green gorge below. I burst the surface, laughing and exhilarated. Minutes later, Nora came howling down the falls after me. When she popped up, she gasped, "You are crazy!"
"You mean you wouldn't have gone if I had been too scared to jump?" I asked, surprised.
"No fucking way," she replied. Right then and there, I should have understood that Nora was not to be trusted. Indonesia offered what seemed like a limitless range of experience, but there was a murky, threatening edge to it. I'd never seen such stark poverty as what was on display in Jakarta, or such naked capitalism at work in the enormous factories and the Texas drawls coming from across the hotel lobby where the oil company executives were drinking. You could spend a lovely hour chatting at the bar with a grandfatherly Brit about the charms of San Francisco and his prize greyhounds back in the UK. But when you took his business card on the way out, he would explain casually that he was an arms dealer. When I rode the elevator to the top of the Jakarta Grand Hyatt at dusk, stepped into the lush garden there, and began to run laps on the track that circuited the roof, I could hear the Muslim call to prayer echoing from mosque to mosque throughout the entire city. After many weeks, I was both sad and relieved to say goodbye to Indonesia and head back to the West. I was homesick. For 4 months of my life, I traveled constantly with Nora, occasionally touching down in the States for a few days. We lived a life of relentless tension, yet it was also crushingly boring. I had little to do other than keep Nora company while she dealt with her mules. I would roam the streets of strange cities all alone. I felt disconnected from the world even as I was seeing it, a person without purpose or place. This was not the adventure I craved. I was lying to my family about every aspect of my life and growing sick and tired of my adopted drug family. During a brief stay in the States to visit with my real and very suspicious family, I received a call from Nora, who said that she needed me to meet her in Chicago. O'Hare Airport was known as a safe airport, whatever that meant, and it was where the drugs were flown. I met her at the Congress Hotel on Michigan Avenue. What a dump, I thought. I was used to the Mandarin Oriental. Nora explained tersely that she needed me to fly out the next day, carrying cash to be dropped off in Brussels. She had to do this for a lodgie, and I had to do it for her. She never asked anything of me, but she was asking now. Deep down, I felt that I had signed up for this situation and could not say no. I was scared, and I agreed to do it. In Europe, things took a darker turn. Nora's business was getting harder for her to maintain, and she was taking reckless chances with couriers, and that was a very scary thing. Her partner Jack joined us in Belgium, and things went downhill rapidly. I thought he was greedy, lecherous, and dangerous, and I could see that Nora trusted him far more than she cared for me. I was scared and miserable, retreating into almost constant silence as we all moved from Belgium to Switzerland. I moped around Zurich alone, while Nora and Jack schemed. I saw the piano 3 times in a row, gratefully transported to another place and time as I cried throughout the movie. When Nora informed me in no uncertain terms that she wanted me to carry drugs, I knew that I was no longer valuable to her unless I could make her money. Obediently, I lost my passport and was issued a new one. She costumed me in glasses, pearls, and a pair of ugly loafers. With makeup, she tried in vain to cover up the fish tattooed on my neck. I was told to get a conservative haircut. Caught in a cold Saturday afternoon rainstorm trying to find a hairdresser who would transform my overgrown blonde tresses into something presentable, I staggered dripping into a tiny salon, the fifth I had tried. I had been met with an Arctic Swiss reception in the previous 4, but now a soft, familiar accent asked, "Y'all need some help?"
I almost cried when I saw the fellow who was asking, a sweet young southerner named Fenwick, who looked like Terence Trent D'Arby. He took my wet coat, sat me down in his chair, and gave me hot tea and a haircut. He was curious but gentle when I balked at explaining myself or my presence in his salon. He talked about New Orleans, music, and Zurich. "It's a great city, but we have a terrible heroin problem here. You see people just lying in the streets, out of it." I felt ashamed. I wanted to go home. I thanked Fenwick profusely as I left his salon, the only friend I had made in months. At any time, with one phone call, my family would have helped rescue me from this mess of my own making. Yet I never placed that call. I thought I had to tough it out on my own. I alone had signed up for this misadventure, and I alone would navigate it to some conclusion, although I was now petrified that it might be a very dismal end. Nora and Alagi developed an elaborate and risky scheme to switch suitcases inside the Zurich airport. But mercifully, the drugs she wanted me to carry never showed up, and I narrowly avoided becoming a drug courier. It seemed like it was only a matter of time before disaster would strike, and I was in way over my head. I knew I had to escape. When we got back to the States, I took the first flight to California I could get. From the safety of the West Coast, I broke all ties with Nora and put my criminal life behind me. Chapter 2. It all changed in an instant. San Francisco was a welcome refuge. I might be a freak, but at least I was among many. I found a place on the Lower Haight with my old friend Alfie, a brewery co-worker from back east who was now living in San Francisco. I was shell-shocked and felt like a smoking chunk of Skylab that had crashed through the atmosphere back to Earth. When Alfie wasn't around, I would sit on the floor of our apartment and ponder what I had done, astonished by how far afield I had wandered and how willing I had been to abandon myself on the journey. I vowed that I would never relinquish my sense of self again to anything or anyone. After spending months in the underworld, it took a while to get used to a normal life. I had been living on room service, exoticism, and anxiety for a long time. But I had several great friends from college now in the Bay Area who took me under their wing, pulling me into a world of work, barbecues, softball games, and other wholesome rituals. I quit smoking. I was terrified all the time about money and immediately got two jobs. I rose early in the morning to get to job one in the Castro, opening Josie's Juice Joint and Cabaret at 7 a.m., and I got home late at night after hostessing at a swank Italian restaurant across town in Pacific Heights. Finally, I got a real job at a TV production company that specialized in infomercials. The job required coaxing passersby onto bizarre exercise equipment in public places, tending to the needs of C-list celebrities on set, and waxing facial hair off perfect strangers. I flew all over the country, filming people who wanted to be less fat, less poor, less wrinkled, less lonely, or less hairy. I found that I could talk to just about anyone, whether it was Bruce Jenner or a mom with a mustache, and find some common ground with them quickly. I wanted to be less poor, lonely, and hairy, too. I worked my way up from Gal Friday to a real producer, working on pre-production, filming, and editing for broadcast. I loved my job, much to the amusement of my friends, who would tease me about the latest late-night life-changing widget, scheme, or cream. I dated, but still felt pretty crispy and gun-shy after the flame-out with Nora. I was fine being serially single, with the occasional crazy romance thrown in to distract me from work. I never talked about my involvement with Nora to new friends, and the number of people who knew my secret remained very small. As time passed, I gradually relaxed inside my head. I started to feel as though there were no second shoe, and it had all been a crazy interlude. I thought I understood risk. I considered my time abroad with Nora as a crash course on the realities of the world, how ugly things can get, and how important it is to stay true to yourself even in the midst of an adventure or experiment. In my travels, I had encountered all kinds of people whose dignity seemed to have a price, widely variable, and I thought that next time I had better set my price higher than anyone would pay. With all that worldly wisdom secreted in my memory, I was feeling pretty damned lucky. Great job, great friends, great city, great social life. Through mutual friends, I met Larry, the only pal I knew who worked as much as I did in leisure-loving San Francisco. He ran a wire service called AlterNet at a nonprofit media institute. When I would crawl exhausted out of the editing room after hours, I could always count on Larry for late dinner or later drinks. In fact, Larry was always up for anything. Random tickets to a random music festival, Larry was in. Want to get up early on Sunday and go to church at Glide in the Tenderloin, and then go on a 6-hour urban hike with pit stops for Bloody Marys? He was Jewish, but sure, he'd come to church and lip-sync the hymns. He wasn't my only straight male friend, but we shared a particularly simpatico sense of humor, and he quickly became the most reliable source of fun that I knew. As Larry's new best lesbian buddy, I got to hear about his every romantic conquest and reversal in gory detail, which was both appalling and entertaining. I spared him nothing in my evaluations of his progress. He returned the favor by treating me like a queen. One evening, a bike messenger arrived at my office with a parcel that yielded a real Philadelphia soft pretzel, complete with spicy mustard, which Larry had personally imported just for me from a trip back east. How sweet, I thought, chewing. But then a disturbing thing happened. Larry got hung up on one of his attempted conquests, and a rather drippy one at that. He became distinctly less fun. I was not the only one who noticed this. "She's leading him around by his nose," other friends smirked. We mocked him mercilessly, but that didn't seem to have much effect. So I had to take matters into my own hands, and in a dark corner of a dirty nightclub, I sacrificed myself for Larry's dignity, kissing him squarely on his surprised, wise-cracking mouth. That got his attention. And mine. What the hell was I thinking? I proceeded to pretend for several months that nothing had happened, while I tried to sort out my feelings. Larry was nothing like any guy I'd ever been involved with in the past. For one thing, I liked him. For another, he was a short, scrappy, eager-to-please guy with big blue eyes, a big grin, and exceedingly big hair. I had deigned to sleep only with tall, exotically handsome narcissists in the past. I didn't particularly want to date a man, and this man wasn't even my type. Except that he was. Larry was completely my type. Even after the weirdness of our barroom kiss, we were still inseparable. Although he was understandably confused, but he didn't push. He didn't demand answers or clarity. He just waited. When I remembered that pretzel, I realized that Larry had been in love with me back then, and I was in love with him. Within months, we were a real official couple, much to the shock of our skeptical friends. In fact, it was the easiest relationship I had ever been in by far. Being with him made me undeniably happy. So, when Larry came to me, conflicted and confused, to tell me that he had been offered a great magazine job back east, it didn't really disturb my equilibrium. My next step seemed so obvious, so natural, that the decision practically made itself. I quit my beloved job to move back east with him. By far, the best risk I have ever taken. Larry and I landed in New York in 1998. He was an editor at a men's magazine. I worked as a freelance producer, and settled in a West Village walk-up. One warm May afternoon, the doorbell rang. I was working at home, still in my pajamas. "Who is it?" I asked over the intercom.
Miss Kerman, it's Officers Maloney and Wong.
Yes? I wondered what the local cops wanted in the building.
Can we speak with you a moment?
What is this about? I was suddenly suspicious.
Miss Kerman, I think it would be better if we spoke face to face.
Maloney and Wong, large men dressed in street clothes, walked up 5 flights of stairs and sat themselves down in the living room. Maloney did all the talking while Wong looked at me impassively.
Miss Kerman, we are U.S. Customs officers. We are here to notify you that you've been indicted in federal court in Chicago on charges of drug smuggling and money laundering.
He handed me a sheet of paper.
You need to appear in court on that date at that place. If you do not appear, you will be taken into custody.
I blinked at him silently, and the veins in my temples suddenly pounded as if I had run miles at top speed. The noise in my head scared me. I had put my past behind me, had kept it secret from just about everyone, even Larry. But that was over. I was shocked at how physical my fear was. Maloney took out a pad and paper and conversationally asked,
"Would you like to make a statement, Miss Kerman?"
"I think I'd better speak with a lawyer, don't you, Officer Maloney?" I staggered uptown to Larry's office, barely remembering to change out of my pajamas. Babbling, I pulled him out onto West 22nd Street.
"What's wrong? Are you mad at me?"
he asked. I drew a deep breath because I couldn't talk otherwise. "I've been indicted in federal court for money laundering and drug trafficking."
"What?"
He was amused. He looked around, as if perhaps we were participating in some secret street theater. "It's true. I'm not making it up. I just came from the house. The feds were there. I need to use a phone. I need a lawyer. Can I use a phone?" Wait, maybe I couldn't use the phone. Maybe all the phones remotely associated with me, including all of Larry's office phones, were tapped. Every crazy, paranoid thing that Nora had ever told me was screaming for attention inside my head. Larry was looking at me as if I had lost my mind. "I need to use someone else's cell phone. Whose phone can I use?" Minutes later, I was on the fire escape outside Larry's office, using Larry's coworker's phone to call a friend in San Francisco who was the biggest big shot lawyer I knew. He got on the line.
"Wallace, it's Piper. 2 federal agents just came to my door and told me that I've been indicted for money laundering and drug trafficking."
Wallace laughed. This was the reaction I would eventually get used to when friends first learned of my predicament.
"Wallace, I'm totally fucking serious. I have no idea what to do. I'm freaking out. You have to help me."
"Where are you calling me from?"
"The fire escape."
"Go find a payphone."
I walked back into Larry's office. "I need to find a payphone."
"Honey, what the hell is going on?" he said.
He looked exasperated, worried, and a little annoyed. "I really don't know. I gotta go make this call. I'll come back and find you." Later, when he heard a condensed and probably less than coherent explanation of the situation, Larry was uncharacteristically quiet. He didn't yell at me for not telling him I was a former criminal before we combined our lives. He didn't chastise me for being a reckless, thoughtless, selfish idiot. As I emptied my savings account for lawyer's fees and bond money, he didn't suggest that perhaps I had ruined my life and his too. He said,
"We'll figure it out."
He said,
"It will all work out, because I love you."
That day was the beginning of a long, torturous expedition through the labyrinth of the U.S. criminal justice system. Wallace helped me find a lawyer. Confronted with the end of my life as I knew it, I adopted my standard pose when in over my head and scared. I closed myself off, telling myself that I had gotten into this mess and it was no one's fault but my own. I would have to figure out a solution on my own. But I wasn't in this alone. My family and my unsuspecting boyfriend came along for the miserable ride.
Larry, my parents, my brother, my grandparents. They all stood by me the entire way, though they were appalled and ashamed by my heretofore hidden criminal past. My father came to New York, and we spent an excruciating 4 hours driving up to New England, where my grandparents were spending the summer. I wasn't feeling hip, cool, adventurous, counterculture, or rebellious. All I felt was that I had willfully hurt and disappointed everyone I loved most and carelessly thrown my life away. What I had done was beyond their comprehension, and I sat in my grandparents' living room rigid with shame at the emergency family meeting, while they questioned me for hours, trying to make some sort of sense of what was happening. "What on earth did you do with the money?" my grandmother asked me finally, mystified. "Well, grandmother, I wasn't really in it for money," I answered lamely.
"Oh, Piper, for heaven's sake," she snapped.
Not only was I a shame and a disappointment, I was an idiot, too. She didn't say I was an idiot. No one actually said I was a shame or a disappointment either. They didn't have to. I knew it. Incredibly, my mother, my father, and my grandparents, all my family, said they loved me. They were worried for me. They would help me. When I left, my grandmother hugged me hard, her tiny arms circling my ribcage. Although my family and the few friends I told took my situation seriously, they doubted that a nice blonde lady like me could ever end up in prison. But my lawyer quickly impressed upon me the severity of my situation. My indictment in federal court for criminal conspiracy had been triggered by the collapse of my ex-lover's drug smuggling operation. Nora, Jack, and 13 others, some of whom I knew and some I did not, including African drug lord Alaji, shared my indictment. Nora and Jack were both in custody, and someone was pointing fingers and naming names. No matter how badly things had ended between us, I never dreamed that Nora would turn me in to try to save her own skin. But when my lawyer sent me the prosecutor's discovery materials, the evidence the government had gathered against me, it included a detailed statement from her that described me carrying cash to Europe. I was in a whole new world, one where conspiracy charges and mandatory minimum sentencing would determine my fate. I learned that a conspiracy charge, rather than identifying individual lawless acts, accuses a group of people of plotting to commit a crime. Conspiracy charges are often brought against a person just on the strength of testimony from a co-conspirator, or, even worse, a confidential informant, someone who has agreed to rat out others in exchange for immunity. Conspiracy charges are beloved by prosecutors because they make it much easier to obtain indictments from grand juries and are a great lever for getting people to plead guilty. Once one person on a conspiracy indictment rolls over, it's pretty easy to convince their co-defendants that they won't stand a chance in open trial. Under a conspiracy charge, I would be sentenced based on the total amount of drugs involved in the operation, not on my small role in it. In the United States, mandatory minimum sentencing was a critical part of the late 20th century war on drugs. Guidelines established by Congress in the 1980s required federal judges to impose set sentences for drug crimes, regardless of the specific circumstances of a case, and without discretion to evaluate the person being sentenced. The federal laws have been widely duplicated by state legislatures. The length of the sentences completely freaked me out. 10, 12, 20 years. Mandatory minimum sentences for drug offenses are the primary reason that the U.S. prison population has ballooned since the 1980s to over 2.5 million people, a nearly 300% increase. We now lock up one out of every 100 adults, far more than any other country in the world. Gently but firmly, my lawyer explained to me that if I wished to go on trial and fight the conspiracy charge, I would be one of the best defendants he had ever worked with, sympathetic and with a story to tell, But if I lost, I risked the maximum sentence, probably over a decade in prison. If I pleaded guilty, make no mistake, I was going to prison, but for a much shorter time. I chose the latter. There were some agonizing conversations with Larry and with my still reeling family, but it was my decision to make. My lawyer negotiated hard and smartly on my behalf, and ultimately, the U.S. Attorney's Office allowed me to plead guilty to money laundering rather than conspiracy, for which they would require a minimum sentence of 30 months in federal prison. On Halloween Day, 1998, Larry and I traveled to Chicago in costume as teenagers. Maybe my misery was masked by the disguise. That night, we hit the town with our friends Gab and Ed, who had no clue about my predicament and thought I was in Chicago for work. The next morning, I was standing tall, if pale, in my best suit, as we went to the federal building where the court was located. With Larry looking on, I choked out three words that sealed my fate. Guilty, Your Honor. Shortly after I pleaded guilty, something surprising happened. Alhaji, the West African drug kingpin, was arrested in London on a U.S. warrant. Suddenly, my date with prison was postponed, indefinitely, while the United States tried to extradite him to stand trial. They wanted me in street clothes, not an orange jumpsuit, to testify against him. There was no end in sight. I spent almost 6 years under supervision by the feds, reporting monthly to my pretrial supervisor, an earnest young woman with an exuberantly curly mullet, and an office in the federal court building down on Pearl Street in Manhattan. Once a month, I would go through building security, ride the elevator up to pretrial services, and sign in, waiting in a dingy room decorated with inspirational and cautionary posters that reminded me about perseverance and to use condoms. I was often alone in the waiting room. Sometimes I was joined by young black or Latino men, who either sized me up silently or stared straight ahead. The occasional thick-necked older white guy with lots of gold jewelry would appear, and he would look at me with frank surprise. Once in a while there would be another female, never white, sometimes accompanied by children. They always ignored me. When my Miss Finnegan would finally appear and beckon, I would trail her to her office, where we would sit awkwardly for a few minutes. So, any news on your case? Nope. Well, this sure is a long one. Every now and then she would apologetically drug test me. I always tested clean. Eventually, Miss Finnegan left the department to go to law school, and I was transferred to the equally mild-mannered Miss Sanchez. She had long Frito chip fingernails painted Barbie pink. "You're my easiest one," she would say every month, cheerfully. Over more than 5 years of waiting, I thought about prison in every imaginable way. My predicament remained a secret from almost everyone I knew. Initially, it was too terrible, too overwhelming, and too uncertain to tell anyone what was happening. When the extradition delay struck, the situation grew too weird to broach with friends who didn't know. "I'm going to prison someday." I felt that I just had to gut it out in silence. My friends who did know were mercifully quiet on the subject as the years dragged on, as if God had put me on hold. I worked hard at forgetting what loomed ahead, pouring my energies into working as a creative director for web companies and exploring downtown New York with Larry and our friends. I needed money to pay my huge ongoing legal fees, so I worked with the clients my hipster colleagues found unsexy and unpalatable. Big telecom, big petrochemicals, and big shadowy holding companies. With everyone but Larry, in my interactions, I was partially absent. Only to him could I reveal my fear and shame. With folks who knew nothing of my criminal secret and looming imprisonment, I was simply not quite myself. Pleasant, sometimes charming, but aloof, distant, perhaps even indifferent. Even with close friends who knew what was happening, I wasn't fully engaged. I was always observing myself with an unstated foresight, a sense that whatever was happening now didn't matter much given what was to come. Somewhere on the horizon was coming devastation, the arrival of Cossacks and hostile Indians. As the years passed, my family almost began to believe that I would be miraculously spared. My mother was certainly logging a lot of hours in church. But never for a minute did I allow myself to indulge in that fantasy. I knew that I would go to prison. There were times when I was pretty damn depressed. But the revelation was that my family and Larry still loved me despite my massive fuck-up, that my friends who knew my situation never turned away from me, and that I could still function in the world professionally and socially, despite having ostensibly ruined my life. I began to grow less fearful about my future, my prospects for happiness, and even about prison as more and more time passed. The main reason was Larry. When I was indicted, we were definitely in love, but just 28 and freshly arrived in New York, we were not thinking about the future beyond where we would move when the guy we were subletting from reappeared from London. When my criminal past reappeared, who could have blamed him if he had sat me down and said, "I did not sign up for this crazy shit. I thought you were good crazy, not scary crazy." Who could predict how a nice Jewish boy from New Jersey would process the information that his ex-lesbian boho wasp girlfriend was also a soon-to-be convicted felon? Who knew that my extroverted, mercurial, over-caffeinated boyfriend would be so patient, so capable, and so resourceful? That when I cried myself into hyperventilation, he would hold my head and comfort me? That he would guard my secret and make it his own? That when I moped for too long, letting the poor me blues clamp around my ankles and drag me down to very bad places, he would fight to get me back, even if it meant terrible battles and tough days and nights at home. In July 2003, we were in Massachusetts at my family's beach shack. On a beautifully sunny day, Larry and I kayaked out to Pea Island, a speck of rock and sand set in a small cove off Buzzard's Bay. The island was placid and deserted. We swam and then sat on a rock looking back at the cove. Larry was fumbling with his swimming trunks, and I eyed him sideways, wondering why he was being so weird. He withdrew a plastic baggie from his swim trunks and from it a metal box. "P, I got you these rings because I love you, and I want you to have them because you mean so much to me. There's 7 of them. For every year we've been together. We don't have to get married if you don't want to, but I want you to have them." Of course, I can't remember another word he said because I was so surprised and astonished and touched and thrilled that I couldn't hear anything more. I just shouted, "Yes!" The box held 7 hammered gold rings, each as thin as manila paper, to be worn stacked. And he had gotten himself a ring, too. A thin silver band that he worried nervously on his finger. My family was ecstatic. Larry's parents were too, but despite the length of my relationship with their son, there was a lot they didn't know about their future daughter-in-law. They had always been kind and welcoming to me, but I was terrified of what their reaction would be to my nasty secret. Carol and Lou were different from my former hippie parents. They were 1950s high school sweethearts who predated the counterculture. They still lived in the bucolic county where they grew up, and they went to football games and bar association dinners. I didn't think they were going to understand my adolescent fascination with the underbelly of society, my involvement in international drug trafficking, or my impending incarceration. By now, more than 5 years had passed since I had been indicted. Larry thought it was important to tell his parents what was happening. We decided to practice on some other people, a tactic Larry described as tell the truth and run. Reactions were pretty consistent. Our friends would laugh uproariously, then have to be persuaded of the truth, then be horrified and worried for me. Despite our friends' responses, I was deeply frightened that my luck would run out with my future in-laws. Larry called his parents and told them there was something important we needed to discuss with them in person. We drove down on an August evening, arrived late, and ate a classic summer dinner. Steak, corn on the cob, big juicy Jersey tomatoes, delicious peach cobbler. Larry and I sat opposite each other at their kitchen table. Carol and Lou looked far more than nervous, but not quite terrified. I think they assumed it was about me and not about Larry. Finally, Larry said, "Bad news, but it's not cancer." The story spilled out of me, with interruptions from Larry. Not entirely coherent, but at least it was out, like a splinter. Carol was sitting next to me, and she took my hand, squeezed it hard, and said, "You were young." Lou tried to organize this radical new information in his head by switching into lawyer mode, asking about my indictment, my lawyer, the court in question, and what he could do to help. And was I a heroin addict? The beautiful irony of Larry's family was that when something minor was amiss, it was as if the Titanic were going down. But when a real disaster struck, they were the people you wanted.